Hello and welcome to Feet First, a podcast focusing on the front of the pack in the UK trail and ultra scene. My name's Ed Scott, and in this episode, I am bringing you a conversation with Brian Wilkins, who recently ran just inside the top 10 at Spartathlon. Brian has been running ultras now for the best part of 10 years, and in the last few years, he has stepped up to be competitive at a national and international level, particularly in road and track-based events. He ran his qualifying time for Spartathlon at the Battersea 24-hour race a couple of years ago, and last year, he went to Athens to run Spartathlon. He ran a time that he was not super satisfied with, but he came back this year and ran an astonishing time of 25 and a half hours. Or just under, which was good enough for ninth place. If you're not familiar with Spartathlon, where have you been? This is one of the world's truly iconic ultras. It's been going for over 40 years. It is a 150-mile run following the footsteps of Pheidippides from Athens to Sparta. It has a very aggressive cutoff of 36 hours, which, when you think about the fact that most 100-milers, at least most runnable 100-milers, have a cutoff of 30 hours, 36 hours for 150 is quite aggressive. Of course, it is a road event, and so the times are much faster than you would expect from a trail event, and the winning times will absolutely blow your mind at Spartathlon. The fact that people are running 150 miles in under 20 hours, well, one person is running that, it's absolutely astonishing. I've always considered myself more of a trail runner. I was not thinking about this kind of event being on the radar for me, but having spoken to Brian and having spoken to other runners in the past like David Bone and Anna Brown on the podcast about their experiences, I think it's fair to say that I've got a bit of a bug now for Spartathlon. I'm thinking about maybe how can I build a roadmap towards maybe one day towing the line. It looks and sounds like an incredible event, and I'm really grateful to Brian for sharing his experience with me. This was the first podcast he's ever been on, so it's a bit of an exclusive, and yeah, really, really grateful to him for sharing his story with me. As ever, if you do enjoy the podcast, then please do give it a rating wherever you are listening to it, and be sure to follow us on Instagram at Run Feet First. You can also follow the new Facebook page, and as of a couple of days ago, there is a Facebook group where you can discuss all things Feet First if you are so interested. Right now, I think it's got one member, which is me, so please do join me there and say hello. You can also join the Strava group as well if you search Feet First. Anyway, that's almost enough waffle from me, but before the episode begins, I just want to take a moment to thank the Centurion Ultra Running Store for supporting the podcast. If you've not heard of them before, Centurion Ultra Running Store are an independent trail and ultra running retailer based right here in the UK. They stock everything from clothing and footwear to bags, packs, accessories, and nutrition. They really are the best in the business when it comes to curating a wide range of excellent running products. Founder James Elson, who you may have heard of, he's actually run Spartathlon as well, and I think he knows Brian from back in the Battersea racing days. I think he's mentioned that. He and his team truly are experts when it comes to what trail and ultra runners need and want from their kit. So when you buy from the Centurion Ultra Running Store, you really are getting your hands on the very best. Excitingly, the Centurion Ultra Running Store is going to be opening its doors more frequently. Yes, there is a physical store you can go to in Hertfordshire, which just so happens to be the county of my birth. No connection there, just an interesting fact. But you can go to Centurion Ultra Running Store in person. You can check out all the gear, get your hands or your feet on some kit, and chat to the team and have a coffee and just discuss what it is you need, and they will be able to advise you. If you want to support the podcast, you can use the code FEETFIRST10. You can certainly use that online. I have not checked if you can use it in person, but, you know, always worth a try. And if nothing else, just say that I sent you and that would be nice. But the code will help support the podcast, and it will also help support the Centurion Ultra Running Store and keep the spirit of independence alive in British ultra running. All right, on with the show. Here is Brian Wilkins. Brian Wilkins, welcome to Feet First. What an honour and a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Ed. Great to be here.
And I believe it's your first ever podcast, so this is everything you say, no matter what it is, will be an exclusive.
Yes, indeed.
We're going to talk about Spartathlon today. For people who are maybe watching this on YouTube or have seen some clips on social, you're wearing your Spartathlon t-shirt, which is very nice. Is that from this year, that t-shirt?
It is, yeah. Yes, yeah, the 2025 version. Right. I've also got the 2024 from last year as well, so I've started to collect them now.
Nice. Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting that you've run this race 2 years in a row, and I'm curious to get a comparison actually of how those experiences went. we're a couple of weeks post race. You ran and, you know, you were running for 25 and a half hours. So how's recovery going? How have you found yourself sort of getting back to life, I guess, in the weeks post race?
Yeah, so your recovery's going pretty well. Really been enjoying some downtime the last couple of weeks, really. So been feeling pretty ravenous, eating loads, yeah, and enjoying a glass of wine and a beer now and again. Kind of back to running a little bit, you know, nothing too heavy. But this weekend, I said I'd pace a good friend at the Autumn 100. So he's going for a course record. So I need to find my form in time for Saturday. So that should be fun.
Is your friend Hugh Tibbs or is this someone else?
It's Callum Pritchard.
Callum Pritchard, amazing.
Yes.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. Well, for listeners who aren't familiar with you, as I say, this is your first ever podcast, although I'm sure anyone who's spent time in the 24-hour scene and the road ultra scene will be familiar with you. Could you maybe just give us a bit of an introduction to who you are as a runner and the journey you've been on? Because as I understand it, you've not been doing this your whole life. Like, you're not a lifelong runner.
No, absolutely. So I probably started running about 10 years ago. When I was younger, and certainly in my 20s, I was living quite a hedonistic lifestyle. So I enjoyed a beer and I was a heavy smoker. And then I got to sort of 28, 29, and I was like, I need to change my life around. It's not very good. So I knocked the cigarettes on the head and really tried to find something else. And running came along, and it was kind of overtook my smoking addiction to something healthier. And I kind of went from there, really. I was always into sport and stuff at school as a kid, and found I had a reasonable aerobic engine, and despite the number of years of abuse from the fags, it was all good. So here I am.
And what was that journey like for you, from, you know, getting into running to ending up running, you know, 150 miles along the roads of Greece? I mean, what was your first ultra? How did you progress into the longer stuff?
Yeah, so I guess I followed a well-trodden path. So started with a 5K park run, 10K half marathon, and a marathon, and then I was kind of found myself chasing a marathon time. You know, trying to get a few minutes off or a few seconds off, but it wasn't really filling me with loads and loads of joy. And then I think it was 2016, maybe I did Race to the Stones, which obviously you know quite well, and. Yeah. Did that over 2 days, so 50K per day. And I loved every minute of it, despite being absolutely broken at the end of day one and more so at the end of day two. I just loved the feeling of fuzzy feeling of satisfaction that you get when you've given everything. And I wanted a bit more of that, you know.
And it's fair to say, is it that you kind of prefer the more runnable courses? You're not someone who's, I don't know, have you got our sights on the UTMB, or are you enjoying the sort of much faster, more runnable stuff?
Yeah, so I guess it's very much dictated by where I live. So we used to live in Wimbledon for a number of years, and it's really flat, and you know, there's a big road running scene up there. So I kind of got into it that way, and then we moved to Winchester last year. So again, it's reasonably flat, although there is the South Downs Way on doorstep, which is nice, so I've been making the most of that for sure. But I guess my running has been dictated by, well, you know, what's sort of available to me closely. I don't particularly want to drive up to Snowdonia or whatever. I just prefer to get out the door in the morning and kind of go for a run.
Yeah, I think that's quite refreshing to hear, to be honest, because I think in the sport we are often fed the narrative that the mountains are where it's at, but to live in a place like Winchester, you've got some fantastic running on the South Downs Way and elsewhere. There's so much great countryside just to run around.
Yeah, it's lovely, actually. It's really, I find it really refreshing. It's a very different type of running to road running. There's no pressure and stuff, and the views up there in the summer are just amazing. And no regrets kind of moving down here. It's been great.
A quick break to thank Trailskin for supporting Feet First. Trailskin, if you haven't heard of them, they craft all natural, high performance skincare products that are designed for runners by runners. Each of their products is made to protect and soothe your skin through the miles, whether you are grinding through ultras or you're just hitting the hills chasing your daily dose of freedom. Trailskin's range is handmade right here in the UK using only natural ingredients. There are no synthetic nasties, and it is tested by a growing roster of brand ambassadors, many of whom have been on Feet First before. It is truly excellent gear. It's the gear you didn't know that your skin needed until now. Make sure you get your hands on some of this, guys, especially as we head into the winter months and your feet are going to be needing a bit of protection and a bit of rehab, I guess, after some of the muddier miles that we'll be tackling, I'm sure, this winter. You can support the podcast if you want to get your hands on some Trailskin product by heading to the website trailskin.com, and you can use the code FEETFIRST20. And that will get you 20% off your next order and £5 store credit towards your second order as well. Highly recommend the Ultra Bundle, which has just everything you need to see you through training and then see you through race day at your next trail or ultra event. And yeah, the code is FEETFIRST20 to support the podcast. All right, back to Brian Wilkins. Well, I know another format you've experimented with is track running, ultra track running. I've spoken to a lot of ultra runners on this podcast who've done crazy things, you know, 300 miles along the Pennine Way and all these crazy things, but I think a lot of them would quake at the idea of doing a 24-hour track race. So what's the appeal of a race format like that for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's it certainly doesn't sound appealing on kind of face value, but I guess having now done it, I found it was like the most pure form of running. You know, there's nothing to think about other than running around in circles. You need to fuel, of course you do, but you know, you can't get lost. There's no hills. Your crew are there, which you know, you see your crew every couple of minutes. So it's you against running almost, and it also kind of brings out the strong mentalities that I've been told I'm quite stubborn and strong willed and stuff. So it kind of plays to my strengths really, and. Whilst I didn't really have any grand plans to do like 24, I kind of found myself training for one doing reasonably well. So it was a good experience overall.
It feels like there's a purity, as you put it, to the 24-hour scene. Like I think of people like Dan Lawson and just the incredible energy that he has. And it's so different to a hardened, grizzled fell runner. It's this kind of lightness and purity that it seems like that scene has.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said around the mentality and the mindfulness. You know, you go to some pretty tough places, and I feel like you need to be able to deal with that and have the strength to keep on going, really. It kind of just suited my grit and determination. I don't know where I get it from, but it's just there, and just don't really want to give up. And a steely competitor.
Well, no doubt that has served you well at Spartathlon, which I do want to talk about. One thing I wanted to ask though before that is, obviously we've got Worlds coming up in a week, 24-hour World Championships. As everything's kicking off in Albie, are you looking at that and thinking, oh, I kind of wish I was over there? Did you have to make a decision or at some point decide between Spartathlon and Worlds, or what was on the
game? So when I did the 24 back in 2023, I think it was, one of my A goal was to maybe knock on the door of the British team, but I fell a bit short of that, which was cool. But it's something that's definitely on my radar in the next couple of years. I've run with some of the team, and there's some phenomenal runners, and I'd like to be part of that in the future one day, all being well.
Yeah, it's not something I've followed before, but I feel like the press around it has been better this year. I feel like I'm really looking forward to, I don't know if I'll watch the whole thing, but I'll definitely tune in now and again.
Yeah, they've got a really strong team, so it's going to be interesting to perform. Yeah, sure.
Well, let's talk a bit about Spartathlon. I mean, one thing I wanted to ask was, this is quite a difficult race to qualify for. It's not an easy one to enter. So where did you run your qualifying time? Obviously, you ran it last year. So what was the journey like to getting into it?
Yeah. So one of the goals of the 24, aside from the GB qualification, was to get an AQ or an auto qualification for the Spartathlon. And I managed to do that at the, as I say, Bassey in 2023. So I think as a male, you have to run 21 hours for 100 miles to get into the ballot. But in order to get an AQ, the automatic, you need to perform 25% better than that. So I think that looked like 15 and a half, 16 hours, something like that, which is pretty punchy. But you know, if you have a good day on the track, then it's eminently doable. And I think I got around 100 miles in 14:45 or something like that. So that was my B or C goal. And I was delighted to come away from the track having got my place in Sparta for the following year.
And for trail runners, a 14 anything 100 miler just sounds insane, but obviously on a track it's different. So what are some data points that people would understand? Like, for instance, what sort of marathon time were you carrying when you ran that time?
Yeah. So I think I probably went through first marathon in, 325, 330. So around about in kilometres per kilometre, 4:45s to right. 5 minute per kilometres. So it's about 2 minutes per lap of the track. So nothing super punchy, but it becomes difficult to maintain that over that, you know, over that 14 hours, particularly with the monotony of the track and whatnot.
And is it one of those deals where you are required to complete the full 24 hours, or are you allowed to stop once you've run that time?
Yeah, so some people kind of stop. Some people have had objectives of just doing 100 miles and getting qualification for Spartathlon or whatever race they were going for. But I guess my A goal was to complete it. Mm. And one of these, I guess the C goal, yeah, was to record the 100-mile time. So it wasn't something that I was massively focusing in on during the race. It was actually running the full 24 hours, but it was a nice byproduct of a good run that day.
Well, you went on to run Spartathlon that year, or the year after, I suppose. You ran 28:50 in 2024. What did that experience give you? It's obviously a hard thing to summarize, but what did it teach you, I guess, about this race?
Yeah, so it was tough. It was really tough in 2024. It was, if I'm honest, it was pretty much a sufferfest from about five hours in. It was a particularly hot year. So I want to say it was 35, 36 degrees from 10 a.m. through to 5 p.m. And the road is it's pretty brutal. There's no shade. There's no coverage. And, you know, if you go out too quickly and you overcook it, then it's trouble. And having done it for the first time that year, I definitely went out too fast and too hard and paid the price. So I kind of got to, I think within sort of eight or 10 hours, I got to a particular aid station, and my wife and my brother-in-law were crewing me. And, you know, I was ready to throw in the towel. I had mild heat exhaustion, so I wasn't able to take on fluids or fuel, and I had no energy, and I was hot, but I wasn't sweating. I really wasn't right. And I think I sat down for maybe 45 minutes and kind of chilled out and went back to basics in terms of nutrition. So water and soup, I think it was. And it was coinciding with it turning a little bit cooler. The sun was about to come down, and I kind of got a bit of a second wind and carried on, thankfully, much to my chagrin at the time, but the delight of my crew, and persevered. But it was just tough. It was horrible. I had this pernicious voice in my head saying, just give up, just knock it on the head. But I got through it, but it wasn't any fun, really. And I kind of approached the race this year with unfinished business, and the main objective being to actually enjoy the thing. And that's what I tried to do.
And so did you know then and there, based on the time you ran, which for a 150-mile race is still a really incredible time. Did you know then and there that you had a place this year, or did you have to re-qualify?
Yeah, so the AQ from Battersea qualified me automatically for 2 years. Whilst I fell short of the AQ from the Spartathlon race, I think it was an hour or two out, I managed to fall back on the Battersea time. So that was handy. And I remember sitting with Anna Brown the day after the race, and we were both like, there's no way we're doing that again. No way. And then a day later, we're like, have you signed up? Yeah.
Well, it's one of those races, is it? It's a bit like, I don't know, Western States or Hard Rocks. If you get a spot, you just have to take it, right? Like, it's such a dream race.
It's iconic. It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, I just felt like a massive unfinished business, and I don't feel like I did myself the justice of the training that I did kind of warranted, and I knew I could do better. And I remember I was being coached by Dave and Daz, so David Bone and Darren Strachan from Camino, and you know, they're veterans of Spartathlon. And I remember Dave saying to me, you really need to run one Spartathlon in order to get a measure of it. I didn't really get it at the time, but having done the race, I absolutely get it now. And there were many things that I was able to tweak and manipulate in order to do better this year.
So what does training look like for a race like this? How much does something like speed work play a role, or is it just lots and lots of miles on the road?
Yeah, so I guess I used what Dave and Daz sort of taught me from last year as like the basis of of success for this year. Because we moved to Winchester, I went with a local coach called Libs Mitchell, who's a recently retired pro triathlete. And she was amazing in terms of really sort of covering every base. So there was a lot of real sort of quality running in there, lots of not massive weeks, like 100k weeks or 120k weeks at a maximum, so 80-ish miles, but real good quality, so maybe two or three good sessions per week, but doing lots of hill work, doing heat acclimatization, doing active heat acclimatization in the midday summer sun, back-to-back long runs at the weekend, that type of thing. And I remember Libs giving me one of her special interval sessions, which was 4 hours of an hour warm up, and then I think it was, if I remember this now, maybe 15 minutes of tempo on, interspersed with lactate threshold and base running. So like 3 hours of effort, and I'm like, my goodness, I'm going to be here after that. And it all turned out pretty well.
And did you run any races in training in the build-up?
Yeah, so I did Race of the King, which I think was the end of June, and I did the 50k for that, and that was quite a hot day. But I've been managing some niggles this year. So I made a conscious effort, having spoken to Libs, my coach, about not racing thereafter, because it knocked the stuffing out of me,
right,
and set me back. So we really focused on doing some quality training sessions and having the consistency of those rather than racing. I think that was the only race that I did during the summer, with the main focus on getting some good quality stuff in on a training perspective.
Mm. And so heading out to Greece, you know, this is a race where it's not just one of those races you show up, you run, you go home. There's a lot of ceremony around it. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance. How much do you lean into that? Do you enjoy that aspect of it, or are you keen to just get to the start and get going?
Yeah, I mean, it's really iconic, and I love the build up. So it's pretty much a week long festival of running. It's a carnival, really. So I think there's 400 runners. There's 45 different countries represented. It's amazing. You know, you've got Uruguay, you've got Hong Kong, you've got Paraguay, you've got all around the world. Absolutely amazing. And you know, you go running on you go out on the Wednesday or the Thursday, and you go out running on, say, the Friday before the race, and you go run along the promenade. So you stay in a small town, seaside town, fairly near Athens, and you're running along the promenade, and you see maybe 10 different nationalities running together in their kit, and you're like, this is brilliant. It's a bit like Comrades, before Comrades, you know, just a real sort of cosmopolitan mix of people. It's a week-long thing, so the Saturday you run and into the Sunday, and then on the Monday the British team have drinks together. On the Tuesday there's a gala dinner with all of the runners and the crew and the support and everything, and that's just mad. And then you go back on the Wednesday, so it really feels like you're in the Spartathlon bubble for a week or so. It's really cool.
You talked about wanting to approach your pacing a bit differently this year, not wanting to go out too hard, but obviously this is a road race where the temptation probably is to go quite fast. So what are those early miles like? And by early, I mean like, you know, like 50 miles, you're still only a third of the way through. How did you approach that?
Yes. So it starts in the morning at 7:00. Right. And having run it last year, I felt like the first few hours was an opportunity to kick on a bit, because it's quite cool. So the first marathon also coincides with the first time you see your crew. So there's various aid stations throughout the run, and some of those aid stations the crew are allowed to attend. I think there's maybe 10 or 12. So kilometer 42 or something like that is where you see your crew for the first time. So it felt like that first segment was something to focus on, to, you know, to have a good run and go out reasonably hard. So I think I covered that in, I don't know, 3:15, something ridiculous.
Wow.
I was running really well. But equally, I was having quite bad stomach issues. So I'd been out to Greece a week before, and I was, you know, eating the local food, and I was in an Airbnb and cooking for myself, but the facilities weren't amazing. Drinking the local water, which may or may not have been a sensible thing. So a couple of days leading up to the race wasn't great. So I'd taken a couple of Imodium the morning of the race, and I was hoping that it would kind of help. But within the first 5K, I was diving into the loo, and that continued every half an hour pretty much for the, for the first, 10, 12 hours, something like that. So it was really about managing that. But equally, my legs felt great. Felt really good. So I was trying to kick on, and then my stomach would cramp. I'd have to jump into the bushes, stop for a couple of minutes, and then kick on again, and then wait for it to all to happen again. So it wasn't ideal, but I was feeling good and fueling all right. So I kind of just went on with it and kind of cracked on, really.
And how much do you? I mean, we haven't really talked about the course as such, because there's this temptation in road ultras to think, oh, it's just a road. But obviously this course has a lot of variation in it. But how much do you sort of chunk it up in your mind? Do you think, okay, the first section is this long and then it's into this? How do you break that down?
Yeah, it's one of my main strategies, actually, because it's such a long way that you just don't want to think about it all in one go. So the first segment being the marathon, the second segment being getting to 50 miles, which is the Corinth Canal, which is quite a big milestone. And then after the first marathon, I was really conscious about not kind of overheating. So like I did last year. So it was all about bringing the effort down, making sure I was fueling really well. I had an ice bandana. I had arm sleeves, which I was putting ice in. I was getting my water bottles filled fairly regularly and stopping at every aid station, which are like 3 or 5K. So making a conscious effort to bring my core temperature down and managing the effort during that time. I mean, it was probably like 30 degrees. So, pretty warm. And, when you're running and there's no cover, you need to be pretty careful about managing that cool temperature. So I was much better this year. You treat the race as segments. And I had in my head all the different segments that I was going to go through and a game plan for each of those segments. So, as the sun came down, around about 5 or 6 o'clock, it was then a case of kicking on a bit, not worrying so much about stopping at aid stations to cool, but obviously taking on the fluid and the fuel and whatnot, and trying to pick the pace up again as much as my weary legs would let me at that point.
And you mentioned the aid stations. They are iconic at this race, partly because there's so many of them. There's like one every 5K, but also because, from what I've heard at least, and I wonder if you can attest to this, they're quite basic.
Yeah, so there's 75 in total.
75.
They're pretty much every couple of K. There's some larger ones where you're lucky to get some hot food, and there's toilets and massages, and it's where the crew can congregate as well. But generally speaking, the aid stations are quite small in the middle of nowhere, and that they serve crisps and peanuts and some other random stuff, and they fill your water up, but that's about it, really. During the heat of the day, there's ice there, but in the middle of the night, there's not really a lot there, to be honest. But it's kind of a good way of breaking up the race as well. So the aid station you get to, it says how long is to the next aid station, so you can kind of focus that in your mind and say, right, so I've got 3 or 4K to go. I'll run for that, and then see how I feel and kick on from there, really. So it's a good way of breaking up the monotony of the race, as it were.
And presumably you can run pretty light, like you don't need to carry too much, I guess.
Yeah, so I was wearing a race pack, and during the day I had 2 500 mil soft flasks, which I was getting through fairly quickly. But at night, when it gets a bit cooler, you probably only need 500 mils on you, and then you can get that filled either at the aid station or by your crew. And I went with my crew because I knew what I wanted and I knew what worked for me. So yeah.
You must be quite liberating in that regard.
One
thing I was going to ask about, we haven't mentioned, is that you came in the top 10, which is a huge result. How early on were you thinking about the competition, and when did it sort of become apparent that you might have a chance at cracking top 10?
It's really interesting. I had my ambitions in my head, and I had my A, B and C goals. But one thing I worked on with Libs, my coach, was to not worry about anyone else, control the controllable, and not really dial into where I was in the race or what my time was. So I told my crew explicitly at the start that I just don't want to know. I've got a plan for each segment, and if I execute that plan well, then overall my race is going to go well. I also, on my watch, I'd set an auto lap to every 5K. So the objective was to run 5K in every 30 minutes. So, you know, 6 minute K. So the math is pretty straightforward. And I was certainly doing that to begin with. And then I was drifting a little bit as the race went on. But I never once looked at my lapse time, so I didn't really know. And then I got to, I think it was aid station 72 with about 10K to go. And my crew were there. And it was the last time I saw my crew before the finish. And my brother-in-law, Ed, who's really into the data, he's an engineer by trade and loves all of that stuff. He said to me, you're on for something really special here. And I'm like, wow, okay, that's all I need to hear.
Yeah.
There was motivation, such motivation, and my legs were screaming at that point. I was popping paracetamol and everything else. But I was like, okay, so I've got an opportunity to do something pretty special. As much as I want to run, as much as I want to walk, I'm going to run. It's painful, but I want to leave everything out there and not have any regrets. And that served me really well the last sort of hour or so.
That's a great bit of wordplay from Ed there, because he's not saying you've got this time to chase or this place to chase. It's just like, keep it up. And you don't even know what it is you're chasing, but you're trying your best to keep going.
Yeah, it was a masterstroke, absolute masterstroke.
Yeah. Well, you ran over 3 hours faster than last year. You ran incredible time of 25 hours, 26 minutes. Where do you think you got that time on the course? What do you chalk that up to? I mean, you mentioned last year wasn't particularly successful in your eyes.
Yeah, so I think a number of things, really. So I think getting the effort right during the day. Mm. So managing the heat, managing the core body temperature, fueling better. So carb mix really worked for me, taking on board solid food as well. So whilst I was having my stomach issues, crisps and pasta were going down really well, and chews and stuff. And I tried to save the gels for a bit later on to give me a kick. I'd also gone in like proper heat climatized. So I spent a bit of time in Dubai in August running out there, which was just crazy heat. And, I felt ready for 30 degrees. It was all good. And I don't know, there was less idle time, really. So, you know, I mentioned I spent 45 minutes at one aid station in particular, sitting down. I didn't have any of that, really. I kind of kicked on, and my aid station game was pretty good. You know, my crew were efficient, and I think I looked at my overall idle time this year. It was maybe an hour, which is pretty good going when you're stopping at every aid station during the day in the midday heat. So all those things, all those increments kind of added up to cut off those hours, really.
In my head, there's one aspect of this course that I don't know why, but it really captures my imagination, and that is the mountain, or at least the mountain road that you climb from, I think it's around the 100-mile mark, which I guess for someone running your kind of time, that's going to be, I guess, in the dead of night, right? Or as the sun is going down. What's that experience like? I mean, talk to me through that section.
Yeah, it was mad. So I think I hit it around 9 p.m. So it was pitch black. So from sort of kilometre 145-ish, I want to say, you start climbing on the road, and it's a series of switchbacks and whatnot. And you probably climb about 700 metres in 5 or 6K. So it's not huge in trail running terms, but you know, you run 140 kilometres therein, and you can feel it in your legs. So
yeah, it's definitely steep.
It's definitely steep, but you know, it's very runnable, most of it anyway. And I tried to focus on doing that. And then you get to the mountain at about, I don't know, 158K, just shy of 100 miles. And that's where you go off road for the first time. So it's a trail effectively. And it's a bit like Box Hill in Surrey on the North Downs Way, where you ascend up a lot of fairly steep steps for maybe 2K. It's the dead of night, it's pitch black. Amazing like clear skies, stars and everything else. It's really surreal, really. Really quiet at that point as well, because a lot of the runners have kind of spread out. Then you get to the top of the mountain, and you then descend quite steeply, and it's fairly precarious coming down because it's shree and loose rocks and stuff. And one of the things I remembered from last year was to change into trail shoes, because I didn't last year. And I changed into a pair of Salomon this year, which had some reasonable tread, and they really served me well going down the other side. And I think I overtook a couple of people going down who were in Alpha Flies and sort of found me on ice almost. So it was a good decision to do that. Although you then get back onto the road and they quickly overtake you in their super shoes. But yeah,
that's amazing actually, because I remember years ago reading an article by a guy who ran Spartathlon in sandals, and I thought, fair enough, roads, you know, if you've got strong feet, you could run on the road. I didn't realise there was proper trail running involved.
Yeah, it's pretty gnarly. I mean, it's by no means, some of the UTMB stuff, but it's for a road runner, it's on the gnarly side. So, and particularly because it's dark and under torchlight, it can be quite precarious up there. But it's really cold as well.
Yeah, I guess the other aspect as well that I picture when I think about this race is the kissing of the feet at the finish line, the feet of the statue, for anyone who's not familiar. What's that finish line like? Is it as much of a climactic moment as it looks?
It's more so, to be honest. It's the end of a journey. You're running half of the country, really. If you look at the map, it's from one end of Greece to the middle of it. And You come up to the finish line and you make a sharp right hand turn, and it's probably 500-600 meters to get to King Leonidas. On either side of the road, there's cafes with support crew giving you a standing ovation, clapping you in. There's people up in the windows cheering, saying bravo, and you're meant to feel like a superhero, to be honest. You take out your Union Jack flag, drape it around your shoulders, and I mean, it's your own personal finish line almost, and you put so much effort into getting there. It's pretty emotional. I must admit to having something in my eye when I finished, for sure. But amazing, really amazing, iconic it was.
Yeah, and what is it? Do you think that it's really hard to put your finger sometimes on what makes a race a classic, because there's so much variety amongst the classics. You know, UTMB is very different to Spartathlon, is very different to South Downs 100, but do you have a sense, having run it twice now, of what it is? Is there a feeling or a culture that you look to, you think that's why this race has endured?
Yeah. It really gets under your skin. It's the whole international feel to it, but it's also the history and heritage. So I believe it started in 1983, but obviously it follows the route of Thapedus, the Athenian messenger, before the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. So you're following in his footsteps, which is unreal, really. And it's just got such a surreal feeling. You feel like you just don't get the feeling in the London Marathon or your local 10K, with all due respect to those events. It just feels on a different level almost. Yeah. And then you've got the British Spartathlon team as well, who they've been running for a number of years, and they do some great stuff to support you, and they give you the kit like I'm sporting today, and you really feel sort of part of a team. There's 20 of you that run, and you all sort of care for each other and want everyone to do well and stuff, and that camaraderie you don't really get in the individual pursuit of ultra running. It's really refreshing.
Yeah, it's a bit like Worlds in that respect, isn't it? It's got this team element to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Is it still under your skin? Are you hoping to return next year or the year after? Or?
Yeah, I was so delighted with my run this year. I mean, it, apart from the stomach, and also I took a 5K detour at one point as well, which didn't help.
But, you did Spartathlon Plus.
Yeah, Spartathlon Plus 5. Yeah. I feel like I've got a sub 24 in there somewhere if everything goes right with a fair wind, and there's a Hall of Fame for British athletes, and I'd like to enter into that a bit higher than I am now. I'm super happy with where I sit there, but I feel like, having done it twice, there's a couple of other things that I can change very slightly, and with the right conditions and on a good day, I can have a real good performance if it all goes well.
It is incredible, coming from a trail world, the times people run at this race. Yeah. And then you think they'd be good for a 100-mile race, and then you think it's 150. It's just absolutely mind-blowing.
There's a chap called Fotis, a Greek national, who I think he's won it the last 4 years. And he broke the long-standing record, I think it was 2023, So he broke 20 hours, which is absolutely insane. I think he went through the first marathon in 2:50 something.
Yeah.
And then he continued to average pace at 13 kilometers per hour or something.
Yeah.
Crazy, including the mountain and stuff. I mean, it's just a different level. It's an incredible run. It's incredible.
I initially wrote this question as a hypothetical, but having spoken to you, I'm now thinking I need to do this race. So if we start on the practical side, if I wanted to go and do this race, what would be your recommendation? Like, how do I get it? I'm not going to be the kind of runner to run a qualifying, an automatic qualifier. So what would you recommend I go and do?
Yeah, so you can absolutely get in via the ballot. So I think it's for males, I think it's 21 hours for 100 miles. And there's various other.
And that's like irrespective, of course, like if you run a track or a road or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. So the flatter course you do, the more advantageous to yourself. So you can do it over 100 miles, but there's various other distances with times and stuff as well. So I want to say there's 120 kilometers in maybe 10 hours or 12 hours. To get into the ballot, and the chances are reasonable in the ballot for sure. And you know, if you do have a storming day and get the auto qualifier, that is 25% better than that. So it's not out of the realms of possibility if you're doing a track race a flat Centurion, for example, where the objective is 100 miles and you're going all out for that distance.
And then on the sort of preparation front, like, if someone was towing the line for the first time, what would be your words of advice to them?
Yeah, I think you need to go all in. So, you know, it's all encompassing. So absolutely treat it as your A race. Mm-hmm. Like this year, it was my one, apart from the Race of the King, it was my one and only focus. And I went all in, I threw all my chips in, and it paid off. But, you know, when it gets tough on the mountain or 120 miles in, you need all the resolve and then the training that you can muster. So, just go all in, really.
Amazing. Well, I'm definitely, I say this after every race, I spoke to David Bone about Badwater and now I'm obsessed with going to that, but I do feel like Spartathlon actually, as you say, it is actually achievable. Like, you can actually get into this race.
Yeah, it's, I really couldn't recommend it more. It's as I say, it's really gone under my skin, and I feel proud to be part of the British team, and I'm proud of my performance, etc. But so delighted to have been able to run it a couple of years running now.
Well, kudos to you. It may seem a bit early to ask this, but what's next for you? Obviously, if you're going to go back to Spartathlon, what are you going to be doing in the intervening months? Have you got plans for races next spring, summer?
So I'm doing Valencia Marathon in December, which is a fast course with a good friend, but haven't really given it much thought, if I'm honest. I've put all my eggs into the Spartathlon basket, so probably need to start training for that fairly soon. But I don't know. I'm kind of indifferent to it, really. I feel like I deserve a little bit of time off and stuff, and I don't want to overexert myself. So maybe next year, something in the spring, I maybe look at doing the Anglo-Celtic Plate, maybe a fast 100K or something like that, or maybe the Centurion Thames Path 100 as another option. There's so many different things out there, isn't there? It's world's your oyster, almost.
Yeah, I think enjoy a few more glasses of wine maybe before you commit to a new project.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Brian, it's been a real privilege to chat to you and find out more about this race. And yeah, as I say, I think it's got under my skin already. I've just got one more question, which I ask everyone on this podcast, and that is, what do you think is the most important thing when it comes to success in ultra running?
Yeah, so I've been giving this some thought, having listened to a number of your podcasts, and I think for me, what was a real game changer was being coached. So I took on a coach from 2023 for the Bassey 24, and it feels like since then my running has gone upwards. It's gone on a massive upward trajectory, and I've changed coaches a couple of times, specifically for the race that I was doing. But just having that accountability and motivation that a coach gives you really serves me well, and kind of takes the thinking out of it as well. You know, so you get your program set for the week, and you know, you turn up and you do the run, and you don't have to think too much about it. So yeah, getting a coach has been my one of my best decisions, really, and onwards and upwards from there, really.
And what was your current coach's name again?
Libs Mitchell. Olivia Mitchell, who's based in Winchester, and yeah, she's a cracking coach.
Shout out to her. No doubt she'll get many requests off the back of your Spartathlon run. Well, Brian, thank you so much for your time. It's been really awesome to meet you and to catch up.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks so much.